if I ever had the patience to sit down and write a book, my book would be this. It's LEGO, L-E-G-O, which is about how are we called and how do we know that we're doing the right thing. The L is for the things that we love. E is experiences. So what has life taught you along the way? G is gifts. So what are your God-given gifts? So what are the things that you just find you're good at? And then the fourth letter is O, which is opportunities. And where the things that you love, your experience, your gifts, and your opportunities converge, they're the opportunities that you should pursue.
Welcome to the Leadership Podcast. What does it mean to lead well in the 21st century? We speak to significant leaders from around the world to learn how to shift our leadership up a gear and become the leaders we're called to be. We learn from leaders from the creative industries, law, church, charities, and more as we seek to make a positive impact in the world. Today, I'm speaking to Andrew Morley. He became the president of World Vision International in early 2019, having been chief administrative officer and chief collaboration officer from January 2016. He joined World Vision after leading and building successful international organizations. He has worked for brands such as Google Mobility, Motorola Mobile, Sky Television, Harrods Group, and the Ford Motor Company. And he was the CEO of Clear Channel UK, an advertising and marketing company. Andrew has a BA honours degree in marketing and theology. He's a member of a long-distance cycling team and enjoys running. Andrew is married to Vanessa, and they have two teenage children, Lewis and James. I know you're going to love this interview with Andrew. He's had such an inspiring and interesting career. His work has taken him from the automotive industry to digital technologies to the world's largest children's charity. With over 39,000 employees, World Vision is making an impact around the world. Andrew spends his time as a full-time president and CEO of World Vision International, while also being a curate at Holy Trinity Brompton, one of the leading churches in the United Kingdom with an influence around the world. There's something about Andrew's infectious desire to make an impact that sees him continually moving from one field to another, taking learning as he goes. If you're someone thinking about moving from one job to another, here is a person that can help you decide when the time to go is and when it's right to stay. Enjoy this interview with Andrew Morley, CEO and President of World Vision International. Andrew, welcome to the Leadership Podcast. It's such a pleasure to meet you. Could you tell me a little bit about the beginning of your leadership journey? Was there someone that kind of spotted you or encouraged you or helped you to notice that you had leadership gifts?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd ever ascribe myself leadership gifts, but other people have mentioned that they felt that leadership was something I was good at, that something where teams that I worked with and teams that worked for me responded well. My first real foray into leadership was at Ford Motor Company. I was there for the first 8 years of my career and all over the world, in Detroit, in Paris, in Germany. But I was given a director role at Ford at the tender age of 29, which then, and apparently still, makes me the youngest director that they've had in the organisation. And the key for me was to really listen to people in the team and try to understand their needs, try and understand their positions. And really, and this was before becoming a Christian, I became a Christian at the age of 30, but really understanding that, particularly because I was so young, that they had much more experience than me. Many had been at the organisation 2-3 times longer than me. But to try and learn from them, but help them to be the best that they could be. So to help them to flourish. And that's really been my core principle for teams that I've worked alongside, just really helping them to flourish.
I love that vision. And a lot of people who are younger find it quite difficult to lead people that are older. Maybe it's a kind of biological challenge that we have. I like this idea that you're coming with humility. What were some things that you might be able to help someone that was in, who is in that current position? They're not quite sure how to lead people with more experience and age seniority. Are there things that you learned from that time?
Yeah, throughout my career, I've almost always led people who know more about the role and know more about the organisation than I do. And one of the things that really helped for me is to be honest and to say to the first teams at Ford, to say, look, you're the experts, you're the ones who know what needs to be done, but I want to help you get done what you need to get done. And also to be really open with them and say, you know, tell me other things that you haven't felt you've had permission or you haven't felt you've had the tools to get done that I can help with, that I can unlock barriers and remove roadblocks to help you be successful. And one of my first roles at Ford, we did that. There's something very simple administrative task that just really sucked lots of time out of people's day. And I said to the team, you know, if I can make this go away, would that help? And they said, well, you can't, because this has been an issue for 20 years. And I just spoke to my then manager and said, look, we've got this issue. We really don't want to do this admin task every day, basically a counting exercise. So what if we just trial for a month not doing it, see what difference it makes to you and us? And we did. And the team just couldn't believe it, that we'd stopped doing this, you know, counting exercise. And then we all stopped doing it across the... This was in one part of the UK. Across the whole UK, we stopped doing it. And it was just asking the question, what if, but really listening to the team. And a few quick wins like that, and I really had their support. When I think back, my first leadership role at Ford, I was 23 when I first had a team working for me. And I made such mistakes. I felt I had all the answers, but I really learned, and I learned that the key thing is to listen.
I love that. Humility is such an important Christian leadership virtue. It seems to have been recognised in the wider business sphere. I think in Good to Great, Jim Collins talks about leaders, doesn't he? That he spots humility as one of the defining features of transformative leaders. And this idea that you're trying to help other people to flourish, this isn't about feathering your own nest or building your own reputation, but you're genuinely trying to invest into other people. I love that. That's a really helpful leadership lesson. Thank you. So was it an engineering background you came from that led you into Ford? Or was it more management? What was your way in?
I wanted to be an engineer. I'm from Sheffield. My dad worked in the steelworks. He was from an engineering background. And I was taking cars apart and putting back together in my teens. And I still love doing things like that. And my sons are really getting into that too. But so I studied physics, maths and business studies at A-level at a technical college in Sheffield with the intention to study engineering. But then I found when we did the business studies course, I really enjoyed marketing and felt I was actually not bad at it. And the context, I opened the alternative school tuck shop age 11. My mum owned a sweet shop then, and I set up an alternative school tuck shop, and I actually did quite well from it. And then I found that I was pretty good at selling things. And then when I found marketing and studied marketing, I thought, well, you know, this is great. I'd love to find out more about this. So in the end, I studied business and marketing at university, but I joined Ford, an engineering organization, in their marketing department. And I've often been in marketing, but for marketing in tech companies or in engineering companies or in complex products. And that's kind of where I'm happiest, this kind of mix of the both. And when I do the personality profile studies, it always comes out that I'm high on creative but high on science, right, which is an unusual profile, but I can see why in my career choices and the things that I've particularly enjoyed, it's been a blend of the both.
That's fascinating. I'm interested in school, business often is not encouraged as a subject to pursue if you're gifted. So for example, in my kids' school, you can study German or you can study German for Business, and German for Business is the easy course. Or, you know, from when I was studying A-levels, bright students were encouraged to study the hard sciences and not so bright students were encouraged to study business. And you think, well, where did that come from? Business is obviously a high demand industry and it needs, you know, creative, intelligent people. But equally in the church, you know, when if you're ever going to get any careers guidance at church, and it's rare that you do, I don't think I've ever heard a youth pastor or a church leader encourage people to enter the world of business. Why do you think both academically and perhaps theologically, businesses seem to be second class in so many places?
Yeah, interesting. At my school, at my secondary school, it's quite a rough school in Sheffield. There weren't many of us that left there with GCSEs. It was a bit of a shock when I ended up doing okay in my GCSEs. But we were very much encouraged into working with our hands. We had lathes in school. We did an afternoon a week, basically in practical, hands-on woodwork, metalwork, technology. And that's what Sheffield was then. This was the mid-80s, and Sheffield was still very much an engineering and production hub. I remember one of my teachers at primary school who taught maths, Mr. Miles. He gave me an excitement for maths which really stuck with me, and he really inspired me. And one of the things that has stuck with me through my career is we can be our own Mr. Miles. You know, we can inspire people to find their gifts and really let their gifts come to life. And for some people, that is business. And it's interesting, I studied business and marketing at the time where there were only two marketing courses in the country. And so it was very unusual to study marketing then. People weren't even quite sure what it was. You know, is this sales? You know, are you going to become a door-to-door salesman as a result of studying this thing? And, you know, the idea of advertising was just like, you would never study advertising. I don't even think there was an advertising course available at that point. But one of the things that, you know, I would say to anybody who's looking to make choices about what they want to study is find what you love, because we can get too really railed into this idea that you've got to do something that's going to be the things that creates the most money or gives you the best professional career. But actually, life's short. And if you do the things that you love and you're passionate about and follow your giftings, then I think that God absolutely blesses that. And that can be business. For many people, that can be business. But there needs to be a passion there, because otherwise it makes university tough. And I really studied something I loved. I was very fortunate. Yeah.
Marketing and advertising also don't normally have a great reputation out in the wider world. I think there was a phrase, we spend money we don't have to buy things we don't need to impress people we don't know. And the way that comes about is through marketing and advertising. So for some people, marketing is in the same space as politics. You know, it's too dirty for Christians to be involved with. What would you say to people that had that kind of negative stereotype about the advertising industry?
Yeah, well, I was 30 when I came to faith on an Alpha course in Chorley Wood. And it was a shock for me. Coming to faith was the last thing I expected. I was invited on an Alpha course by a friend. My wife and I both went along just to basically satisfy him. But after I came to faith, I was 30, 31, I was at Sky TV. I was director of marketing for Sky TV UK and also general manager for Sky in Ireland. It was my next job after Ford. And it was all about advertising. My role was all about advertising in an organisation which, you know, we had a betting wing to the organisation Sky Bet. We also, the platform carried adult channels, adult TV channels. So coming to faith, lots of questions around, is this the right place for me to be? Is advertising the right place for me to be? Is advertising products similar to the ones that Sky have the right thing? And I just thought, well, what was the alternative? If the alternative is not having a Christian in these roles and not being able to make that influence and give that influence and to be that voice of conscience in that environment, then I really felt it was where I was called to be. And I was there for another 5 years after coming to faith. And I really felt like I wouldn't allow my faith to be compromised, my newfound enthusiastic faith. There were things that I said no to. And Sky had incredible respect for those, for the kind of the hard lines for me. And I just felt that it was that God calls us to be in the marketplace. And there's nowhere that's more that marketplace where, you know, markets are places where people buy and sell. There's nowhere more that marketplace, I think, than marketing and advertising. So if you feel called to be there, then God will honour that. And you can be a difference and you can make a difference in those environments, possibly much more than you can in other safer environments.
I'm really with you. I've been studying the book of Daniel and Esther during lockdown because I think they've got a lot to say into this kind of cultural moment. And you think, well, thank God that he placed Daniel in the court of a crazy despotic king like Nebuchadnezzar. Thank God he was there because he can make a difference. Think of the difference he made. Or even Esther, you know, and it was pretty difficult, her journey to end up in the king's harem. It's probably some form of people trafficking in the ancient world. And yet, thank God he placed Esther there so that she could speak up and be the voice of conscience during a time of genocide against the Jewish nation. So I'm really with you. I think God can send us into some really unusual places. What did you find as a young Christian, though, that kept you grounded, that helped you, I suppose, be that voice of challenge in an industry that has got some pretty difficult things? How did you stop yourself just assimilating to the kind of wider cultural norms?
Yeah, in Sky, we had a prayer group, actually. I had an office in the top floor of Sky, and on my office door, I had a poster that said, "Join us for prayer at 1 o'clock on Wednesday afternoons." And that group, we were very visible. We put notes up on the notice board, on the intranet. We were very visible, saying that we were praying for the organisation. But that was kind of an in-organisation accountability group, which was so helpful. And we could talk about things with people who understood the context. That was just so helpful for me as a young, new Christian. But the big difference for me was my home group, which was led by a couple who are now very close friends here in Chorley Wood. And they really helped, both from a corporate background, but both deeply faithful in their walk, and really helped as we navigated some tricky challenges. You know, as we bought Sky Bet as an organisation, this is betting, this is gambling, and I was there helping to promote it. And how do we do this in a way that we keep true to our faith and true to the role that we're paid for and called to do? So accountability groups have always been really important to me. And we had, there were people who came out of the woodwork, literally, very senior in the organisation, to people who were in reception. We all sat round together, but people who shared a passion for the organisation, but also shared a passion for their faith. It was so, so helpful as an early Christian.
Amazing. We're back to the book of Daniel. He had Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, and they seemed to be together when they were studying. And then when they get their jobs in the equivalent of the civil service of the Babylonian Empire, they're still with each other. And I think there is a biblical model here, isn't there, of staying accountable?
Yeah, you're right. There is a biblical model of staying accountable. And I love the fact that also Daniel had his firm lines. He had his, look, there are things that I won't do. I won't bow down. I won't stop my prayer. And so having those non-negotiables and being clear, and I was very clear about some things that I would not do and very open about them. And that really helped, because in the end, people kind of didn't ask. And you send a signal and you also keep your integrity in place. And this was at a time where Rupert Murdoch, he was ultimately in control of the holding organisation. His son, James Murdoch, was my leader there for 3 years. And so, you know, people with very different views on the world. I've also worked for Mohammed Al-Fayed at Harrods. So I've worked for people who have a very different view on life to me. People I respect, though. All three of them I respect greatly. But yeah, so I've been in some of those challenging environments. So I do, when I read Daniel, I can kind of say, yeah, I hear you.
So you move from the automotive industry to the world of television and broadcasting. Was Harrods the next move after that?
I worked at Cable and Wireless. I ran their internet division for a year. Basically, we bought a company or assimilated a company into Cable and Wireless and then sold it again a year later. It was called Bulldog. And so that was my first real taste of mergers and acquisitions, both sides, in a year, in very quick succession. So that was tech. I'd always had a passion for tech. And Sky was, we had lots of technology in Sky too. And then I went from there to Harrods. So I was the group marketing director at Harrods. So for Harrods the Store, the Ritz Paris, Fulham Football Club, all Mohammed Al-Fayed's organisations, as was then.
These are quite big changes of industry and I guess operating procedures. How did you know it was time to move? A lot of Christians are uncertain about guidance, I guess, in those kind of career moves. Looking back, are there lessons that you learned about when to stay and when to go?
Yeah, prayer is a big part of this, and the wise counsel of those friends and accountability groups I mentioned. But every preacher has a sermon that they haven't preached. And my sermon that I haven't preached, and it's my book, if I ever had the patience to sit down and write a book, my book would be this. It's Lego, L-E-G-O, which is about the building blocks of our lives. But it's about how are we called and how do we know that we're doing the right thing in our lives, following our calling. The L is for the things that we love. So for me, I love, you know, I love working with cars. I love technology. I'm an extreme extrovert. So I love being surrounded by people. So they're the things that I love. And I also have a deep love of Christ too. So that's the L. The E is experiences. So what has God taught you along the way? What has life taught you along the way? What have you experienced in life? So that's the E. The G is gifts. So what are your God-given gifts and what are your spiritual gifts and what are the things that you just find you're good at? And they're not necessarily things that you like, because sometimes we're good at things that we don't enjoy, but what are your gifts? And then the fourth letter is O, which is opportunities. So where is the door opening? Where is God opening the door? Where is the world giving you opportunities? And where the things that you love, your experience, your gifts and your opportunities converge, that's when you're being called. They're the opportunities that you should pursue. And then it's how you then build your life on these opportunities, because you know, Lego is fundamentally about building. That's something that I've been ruminating on for about 20 years. But that's, I think, how I felt called when those four things have come together, and where the things that I really feel passionate about build on my experience, build on the things that I can do, and an opportunity arises.
That sounds a book I'd like to buy, and I know a lot of people that would like to read it, so you should get it done soon, I reckon. That could be a nice little video series, I reckon.
Yeah, I'll give you that one, Chris. If you want to use that one, I'll give you that one.
You're very kind. I'll have to copyright you. So you end up working with the Harrods Group. Where do you go next? What's beyond that?
So Harrods, I was the, and I think I still am, the longest serving marketing director at Harrods, and I loved it there. In one day at Harrods, I had breakfast with Eva Longoria of Desperate Housewives fame. She opened the sale. I had lunch with Liz Hurley, who was selling us her new swimwear range, which we took, funny enough. And I had dinner with Father Christmas.
Right.
All in one day.
That's a day.
So it was just such a great experience. I loved it. And it's such a unique store. And I held a carol service at Harrods inside the store and had Nikki Gumbel as our preacher at the carol service. I gave my personal testimony, and we had a number of people give their life to Christ in Harrods, the store, with Mohammed Al-Fayed sat in the front row as we're doing the carols and mince pies. So I had some great experiences there. I loved it. But from there, I moved to Motorola, mobile phones. A love of tech, always had a love of tech. And I was their international marketing director. And I was with them for 8 years. That's when I moved to Singapore, because we based ourselves in Singapore for a while. Spent some time in Chicago in the head office. And loved mobile and loved this idea of the connection that mobile could bring.
Mm.
But also we did lots of work with places like Kenya, with M-Pesa, which is their mobile payments solution. We were the tech partner. We were very keen to bring good through what we did. And yeah, I still have a passion for that organisation. Then we were bought by Google. So Google bought Motorola. And as part of that, I joined the Google team and then ran the mobile operation for the UK. And I was also involved there in Google Glass, which you may recall were the glasses. But yes.
You've got to tell us something about Google. I got to visit the campus in Palo Alto and found it fascinating. I gave a seminar in a back room somewhere, so I'm sure there was only six people on it, but it was a privilege to be there. It does feel like a really fun place to be. You never seem to be very far away from food and free food, really good free food. It's almost like Google wants you to spend as much time as possible on the campus so that you can be working more. And I don't know, I think you can bring your dog to work. I think there's a gym there. There's these little eggs that you can sleep in. What was it like to be there? Was it as fun as it looks?
It was great. I loved it. My nickname there was Grandad, because I was older than almost everybody else I worked with. I spent some time in Mountain View in the Googleplex, and we saw the self-driving cars when they were just being created. It's a very exciting place to work. It really is. People want to be there. They want to be in the office rather than the food being the reason they're there. They want to be there, so they need food. I remember my first town hall with Larry Page. There were 300 of us, of the senior leaders, in a room, and he did his annual address. And this annual address is famous for being anything from 3 minutes to 3 hours. And Larry Page came in, sat on a bar stool. I was so excited. And he started it by saying, "There's no such thing as a good, slow decision." And then he got down off his bar stool and walked towards the door, and I thought, I can't believe this.
No.
This could be my one time to hear Larry Page, and it's the 3-minute version rather than the 3-hour version. Anyway, he closed the door because the door was open and came back and sat on the bar stool and spoke for 3 hours about the need for agility, the need to make good quality decisions, but to make them as quickly as possible. And it's really stuck with me. And this saying, there's no such thing as a good slow decision, is something I've used a lot. And we use it at World Vision 2 now. But I learned so much. You know, the people there are so bright. I found them very accommodating of my faith, actually, very. Even to the point where they would support things that I needed to do with my faith and almost promote that, which was a great, that I found that a very open and supportive place to work. Yeah, I loved it. And I was only there a few years, but I really enjoyed it. And it was a difficult wrench to move, but I was offered another CEO position in an advertising organisation called Clear Channel. And I'd always loved advertising, but always worked, we call it client side, so always been a client rather than someone who's coming up with the creative ideas and the media and the content. So it was an opportunity to do that. And it was just too good an opportunity to refuse. And it was a point at which people didn't leave Google. Though I was fairly old for Google at the time, and I don't suppose I would have been there too much longer, but I left, and I've had a blessed career.
It's incredible. It's amazing.
I've never been in a role that I haven't enjoyed, and when I haven't enjoyed it, it's been time to leave. And each time it's been time to leave, then the door's really open for me to do something else new and exciting and interesting. So
I can't let you move on from Google without just a little bit more on this. There's no such thing as a good slow decision. The industry has this reputation, doesn't it, of moving fast and breaking things and as you say, agility. Can you help us? Because for some leaders, there's a nervousness of moving too quickly and leaving everybody behind and not consulting enough. And there's that fear about making decisions too quickly. But you're right, our world is also changing very fast. And therefore, if you snooze, you lose. Can you help us understand a little bit more about what Larry Page meant about there being no such thing as a good slow decision?
He meant, and he was very expressive and very articulate how he described this, he said, look, we should never make decisions that are rash. We should never make decisions without bringing those that need to be brought along with us. But we have to have a bias for action and to move as quickly as we can. And it's a bit like one of the things that Google talk a lot about is sprints. So the idea that you try and do something quickly, but you keep it small and manageable. Often trials, so you try something and you tell the whole world it's a trial. Not that I knew this before Larry Page, but similar to, actually I've just thought, similar to the story I said about the admin at Ford, where we wanted to stop doing something, but to try and have it abolished would have taken years, but just to say, well, why don't we try it for a few weeks without doing it and see what happens? But the idea of trying to do something small and manageable quickly, and sprints are often 6 weeks or less, where you try and do something and just try something, tell the world, tell all those that matter that you're trying something, and then learn from it and learn fast and fail fast. And the thing that I love at Google is that they, and I've been at other organisations, including World Vision, that have tried this, but Google have a real culture of it's okay to fail. It really is. And the fail fest, you may have heard of this, but it's where across the organisation we celebrate the biggest failures. And you're awarded for a failure where you've tried to do something that's new and transformational, that's not worked. You know, like the Einstein thing about how do you create brilliance? And he said, I try something and fail 100 times, but on the 101st time, brilliance happens. And it's just, you know, trying something. And you've got to be a bit careful. As a CEO particularly, you've got to be careful that you don't create chaos and that you don't create instability, which means that people feel uneasy and feel unhappy and insecure in their roles, but always for that bias to move as quickly as you can and as quickly as the organisation can.
Fantastic. Andrew, thank you. And I'm fascinated by your career. You've had so many interesting places to work. I could talk about all of them for a lot longer. I want to get us to World Vision and the work you're doing there. But just before, just a reflection. So for some people, their job has been to stay at one organisation for the entirety of their career. We're all in awe and admiration of Nicky Gumbel, for example. Here's a man who's stayed at one church and he's innovated within it and done all sorts of stuff. But he's been present and faithful in one place for a very long time. And that's helped bring huge impact. But you've had lots of impact in lots of different places. And I guess, you know, God will lead us in different ways. But for those people that say, you know, why haven't you stayed anywhere for longer? Could you have made greater impact if you'd stayed still? What would you say? I mean, you know, God has different plans for different people. But what's your reflection looking back at these huge amounts of impact you've had in lots of different places?
Yeah, I've been at two organisations for 8 years. So Motorola and Ford, in a couple of places for 5 years, and 5 years nearly at World Vision, but have been in lots of places. And I serve under Nicky Gumbel, so he's obviously, he's the vicar that we all serve under at Holy Trinity Brompton. And he loves what he does, and he's fabulous at it. So I would say, if you went back to Lego, his loves, his experience and his gifts and his opportunities are where he is. And he feels passionate about HTB and is an incredibly inspirational leader in every way, and innovates in a way that's just incredible. He's always innovating, always coming up with new impactful ideas, not just new gimmicks, but things that make a big difference. What he's doing now, helping with the Peter Stream to try and bring people of a different background into the church, just incredible, inspirational. And I attend HTB on Sundays. So I'm, at the moment, it's all virtual, so I'm supporting behind the scenes. And I tend to attend the staff meeting once a week, which is an hour, the Tuesday mornings, and then the clergy meeting, which is once a month. So that's the level of contact I have at HTB. My full-time role is very much at World Vision. But I love it, and I feel energised. I learn so much from him. I could sit and listen at his feet for hours. So he's in the right place. He is absolutely, without doubt, in the right place. But he has innovated and he hasn't stood still. So it's not been 20 years of the same experience repeated 20 times. He's innovating and he's pushing the boundaries. And I would say that if you're happy and fulfilled and having an impact where you are, you might well be in the right place, and that might well be your position for 20 years. And if that's the case, and it's the case for many people at World Vision, we've got lots of people. We're just saying goodbye to someone this week who's had 36 years of service. He's just retiring now, and that's fabulous. But again, likewise, he's somebody who's brought a huge impact and continued to bring impact into the, you know, his last few years at World Vision. So it can be, it's not right for all of us to move, but it's also not right for all of us to stay. Particularly, the least happy I've ever been in a role was where I stayed 6 months too long. I felt it was time to move. I was waiting for a bonus, frankly, and I was very comfortable in my role. We were doing very well, but I should have moved 6 months early. And when I moved, I felt refreshed and renewed, and I felt my energy and soul lift. So sometimes it's time to move, but sometimes it's right to stay.
That's really helpful. I guess it's like the body principle, isn't it? That there's great benefit in people that stay in an organisation a long time because they can bring institutional memory and consistency and reliability. But actually, people that move can bring fresh ideas and innovation and cross-fertilisation of insight in a way that people that stay can't. So hopefully you get the right balance for your own life and the organisations that you're serving. So fascinating. Really, really interesting. I'm personally finding this really helpful, so thank you. The Leadership Podcast is brought to you by World Vision, a global Christian humanitarian organisation with over 70 years of experience, working alongside communities, churches, donors, partners and governments to help the most vulnerable children reach their full potential by tackling the root causes of poverty and injustice. World Vision partners with churches through discipleship tools and experiences that will strengthen families, transform churches and set your people on mission to serve the least of these in your community around the world. Tell us about this move then to become a curate and to lead a global Christian charity. I mean, that's not the normal career path for someone who's had the background that you have. How did it happen, and what is your weekly kind of routine look like nowadays?
So I was at a New Wine conference about 10 years ago. And I'd spoken at church a lot. The month after my Alpha course, I was asked to speak at our local church. basically to give a testimony, and that was well received. And then I was asked to speak again the following month, and I was very soon on the regular preacher's rota. And when people see you preach at church, they automatically, they want to put a dog collar on you. So right from very soon after becoming a Christian, people were saying you should become a vicar because I spoke at church largely. So I didn't really take a lot of notice of that. Very happy in my career. And then the vicar at Christ Church in Chorley Wood, Gavin Collins, said, look, you know, I really think you should look at this quite closely. So I said, look, Gavin, I'll pray about it, think about it. And then I was at a New Wine conference with Gavin and with our church, and Justin Welby spoke. And he said, I really feel that some people here today are called to ordination. And I had my wife on one side and Gavin on the other. And I had two elbows, an elbow from each side. And Justin Welby said, I'd love for those who feel called to ordination to come forward. And this was the big tent at New Wine, probably 5,000-6,000 people in the tent. And about 300 people went forward to the stage.
Wow.
Lots of people. And so I'm stood at the front of the stage, and I was with Google at the time, actually. And Justin Welby walked from one side of the stage all the way across to the other side of the stage where I was stood. And he leaned over and said, what's your name? I told him my name, and he said, what do you do? And I told him, and he said, I really think you should go into ordination. He said, can I pray for you? And so he said a very quick prayer, and he said, here's my contact details, drop me an email afterwards and we'll get in touch. And I thought, if he's going to do this with 300 people, this is going to take a very long time. But then he stood up, walked to the centre of the stage, gave a general blessing to everyone and said, follow up with your local church, and then walked off. So then Gavin Collins was behind me, tapped me on the shoulder and said, now you're listening. And I said, yeah, I pushed the door. I still didn't feel it was right. I was very reluctant, but then went through the discernment process, which took a couple of years, and was told that the church felt they had a calling on my life. I went through the bishop's conference. Wow. And the plan was then, I thought, well, if this is where I'm being called, I'm going to do this full time. So the plan was then to leave work and to become a full-time minister, vicar. And I trained along that route. And then I was on the board of Christian Aid. I was a trustee of Christian Aid, basically helping them with their digital proposition. And so that was my one kind of foray into not-for-profit. I'd helped to set up a charity in Kenya 5 years previous, which is still running, a very small child sponsorship charity in northern Kenya, but very little experience of NGO. And then I got a phone call for someone who said, we want to talk to you about this organisation, World Vision. And I said, look, I'm very happy where I am. I'm not looking to move. I was at Clear Channel at the time, which was the advertising agency. I'm not looking to move. And they said, well, just come and talk, because we think you might be able to help us find someone who's a Christian, but also with leadership experience that can look at this role at World Vision. So I went along and all seemed very interesting. And then I met the then president, Kevin Jenkins, of World Vision International. And within 10 minutes, I knew I wanted this job.
Wow.
And it wasn't a leadership position, so it was a chief operating officer. And when I'd been in leadership, in the ultimate leadership position, for about 10 years up to that point, so it's very difficult to not be a leader when you have been. But I really felt like I was called to this role. And at the end, I said two things to Kevin. I said, first of all, if you were to offer me this job, I would take it. I really feel called, and I feel just passionate about how you talk about changing children's lives across the world, the most vulnerable children who need it most. World Vision's often in the places where other people won't go. You know, we're in Syria, we're in the Democratic Republic of Congo. I was there in February and saw our work there. Many agencies won't go to places that we go to, but making a difference where, frankly, where Jesus would be, and where he calls us to be. So I said, yeah, if you were to offer me this role, I would take it. And Kevin said at that point, said, this is a long process. In the end, it was 13 interviews.
What?
13, yeah. But he said, look, I feel very positive about everything I've heard over the last hour, and I really feel you could be right for the role. And I said, and the second thing is, if you were to offer me this role, I would do it for free. And he said, look, we won't ask you to do that. We don't feel that's right. But thank you for, you know, sharing your passion on the role. And the more I got to see the people in World Vision, the more I got to see the work, I just knew it was what I wanted to do. And I knew that either I would take an exec role there, or I would become a volunteer, or be on the board, or I knew this was an organisation I wanted to be involved in.
Amazing, amazing. So, and how long have you been there now, and what does your current role mean? How does it work?
So I've been at World Vision for 5 years, nearly, 4.5 actually. But for the first 3 years, I was Chief Operating Officer, which is basically, in corporate, it would be the COO, basically. Somebody who's responsible for operations, not what happens in the field, but finance, HR, marketing, basically the back office side of the organisation. And that's for World Vision International, so that's across the globe, that's across the 100 countries that we operate in, 37,000 staff. And I also led a couple of our crisis leadership teams. So as crisis evolved, I had some experience in managing crises. So I led a couple of those teams. And then when Kevin announced he was going to move on 2 years ago, I was asked to apply for the president and CEO role. Not my intention at all. Never. It wasn't my plan. My plan was to go into full-time ministry. But prayed about it and met some people on the search committee at the board, and felt like I was being called to do this for this season, and felt incredibly privileged to be offered the role again. And very long interview process, interviews in the UK and in Singapore for the role, lots of interviews, lots of people, lots of discernment. But in the end, the board felt that I was the right person for the role, and I, in prayer, felt like it was right for me too. And so I've been doing this role now for effectively 18 months, and I absolutely love it. I wake up each morning and I almost have to pinch myself that I'm doing a job that I love so much. And I've often had roles that I've enjoyed, but this is just a step above. It's tough, but it's incredibly, incredibly rewarding.
Amazing. I love this Lego brick analogy that you've been using throughout our conversation, that God would have been building into you all these different skills that ultimately you can now apply into an organization of the scale and impact and heart and vision that World Vision brings. And they are the largest children's charity in the world, with Christian faith at the very heart of it. So it does seem to connect all the different experiences that you've had to be able to be impactful that way. It's been fantastic. For people that aren't kind of up to speed with World Vision's approach, I mean, not everybody knows about the kind of Christian distinctives at the heart of World Vision. Can you speak a little bit about that so that people can understand that a bit more?
Yeah, the three things that really help World Vision to stand apart is, one, we are Christian at the core. We're Christ-centred. We always have been, as part of the new strategy that was launched that I helped to create 3 years ago. We talk about having Christ at the centre as the kind of the cornerstone of all we do. But we've always been Christ-centred. And Bob Pierce, who set up the organisation, created the organisation 70 years ago, famously, he was a pastor, but he famously set up the organisation with the phrase, "Let my heart be broken with the things that break the heart of God." So that's why we feel so called to go to the toughest places and to places where others often won't go. So Christ-centred. The second one is, we're community empowering. So we are almost always, almost without exception, our staff are from the communities in which they serve. So we don't have a model of sending expats in to lead local countries. We have almost exclusively local leaders. At the community, it's local community that we help to empower and enable and support. And so it's those two together. We have a global scale, which means that we can respond very quickly. And so that, particularly because we're child focused, that particularly helps us to respond to crises, to natural disasters. We're seen, and all my peers in other large agencies all say that we're always the first on the ground because we're so close by. We're in 100 countries. We can get there. In Sulawesi, where the tsunami hit a couple of years ago in Indonesia, we were there 2 days before anybody else arrived because we were just round the corner anyway. And people couldn't get there. You couldn't get there by sea. You couldn't get there by land. So, yeah, so that's who World Vision are. Our primary model is child sponsorship. So we support children across the world with a sponsorship model. You can see some of my children that I sponsor behind me. I sponsor six children now, most of which I've met And I'm passionate about the relationship that I have with the children that I support, enabling them to be all that they can be and for them to flourish. I'm just passionate about that. And I helped to set up a child sponsorship charity 10 years ago. So I was already sold on a small one in Northern Kenya. I'm already sold on that model. But yeah, that's what we do. And if anybody's not sure about how they can help, I would say do one thing for World Vision. The one thing that you can do that would make the biggest difference, and I said this to a major donor who I sat across from in Singapore a couple of years ago, who asked me what we needed, and I said, I need you to do one thing for me. And he said, what's that? And I said, I want you to commit to pray for what we do, because what we do is just too tough to do without God. If you don't do anything else, please do that. And if you find that you'd like to financially support us, to sponsor a child, that's great. But I would cherish your prayers above anything else.
I come away from my conversation with Andrew really inspired. I love his humility and vulnerability, talking about the challenges of being a Christian in some pretty difficult circumstances. I love the way that Daniel's story, his friends Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego and the accountability group they founded in Babylon can act as a model to all of us today as we seek to stay faithful to God in the difficult circumstances we're sent by him to go and lead in. After we'd finished talking, Andrew offered to pray for me, and there's a great sign there in his humility and his humanity. Such a visionary leader taking hold of the largest children's charity in the world gives us hope that Christians can make an impact both in the secular world and in the sacred world. There's a way that we can serve God wherever he places us. Maybe today's lesson is thinking through how we know where we belong. Are we supposed to stay where we are, or is God opening up new opportunities for us? Knowing when to stay and when to go is an important leadership in our own development. Friends, this has been the Leadership Podcast. I'm Krish Kandaya, and together we've been thinking about how we shift our leadership up a gear. Now, please remember to like and rate us wherever you listen to your podcast, and join us again soon on the next edition of Leadership.